Hello and welcome to the Sydney Institute podcast. The Institute is Australia's premier current affairs forum. Every week, contemporary political, social, cultural and economic issues are explored at the Institute through dialogue and discussion. This podcast was recorded recently at a members' forum in the city of Sydney. Thanks for listening, and for more information about the Sydney Institute, please visit www.thesydneyinstitute.com.au. We hope you enjoy this event.
Thanks for coming along tonight, folks, where James Curran makes a welcome return to the Sydney Institute. He's well known to many of you, but I will introduce him. He teaches history at Sydney University and is a research associate at the US Studies Centre. He's the author of Curtin's Empire, The Power of Speech, Australian Prime Ministers Defining the National Interest, and together with Stuart Ward, The Unknown Nation, Australia After Empire, and was that topic that Dr. Curran was last at the Sydney Institute. Tonight he's here on the occasion of the publication of his most recent book, Unholy Fury, Whitlam and Nixon at War, which has just been released. And our speaker's going to talk to us on Nixon and Whitlam at War. James Curran, you're very welcome. Thank you.
Well, thank you very much, Jared and Anne, for having me back. And thank you to all of you, sincerely, for your patience. I am sorry that I was running late. Okay. Now, on the surface, it might seem inevitable that Gough Whitlam and Richard Nixon would clash, and clash spectacularly. After all, Whitlam was the very kind of effete social democrat that Nixon had come to despise and mistrust. Another leftist at a time when Nixon felt some left-of-centre governments around the globe were abandoning him over Vietnam and retreating from the concept of Western defence generally. Just a couple of years before, Nixon had said to his advisers, "It's too much the fashion for our allies to kick us around. We can't be sensitive, he said, but we have to be coldly proper, not because we want to hurt them, but because we want to show that we can't be kicked around." If Whitlam was gregarious, Nixon was insular, a self-declared introvert in an extrovert's profession. If the Australian had shown a willingness to accept China and the Soviet Union as the facts of international life since he entered Parliament in 1953, Nixon by that time was already the poster boy of the Republican right, a staunch cold warrior, a red baiter par excellence. If Whitlam looked askance at the Munich myth of appeasement, Nixon gave it the fullest rhetorical flourish. And yet the real surprise is that these two leaders had so much in common. Both had known only too well the loneliness of the political wilderness, and both had used their time in those bleak woods to think deeply about the world and their country's role in it. Possessed of powerful egos, both were eager to reshape the foreign policy of their respective countries, both keen to welcome the opportunities brought on by the advent of a more multipolar world. And both of them, of course, were hurtling along the diplomatic trail to China at almost precisely the same time. Both of them in 1972, coming off the back of significant election victories. That the antagonism between the two ran so deep, that it became so bitter, and that it had near catastrophic consequences for the US-Australia alliance was not simply due to their strong disagreement over the end of the Vietnam War and the controversial Christmas bombings of North Vietnam in 1972. Nor was it due to the fact that just as Whitlam was enjoying his first golden moments in the electoral sun, Nixon was beginning to stare down the barrel of political oblivion as a result of the lethal drip of revelations relating to the Watergate scandal. Nor even was it due to the inflamed throats of various Labor ministers hurling abuse at the President and his advisers, or the speed with which Whitlam moved to recognise communist countries or change Australia's voting patterns at the United Nations once he got into office. All of these factors played a part, but the frisson and the fury had a deeper source. There were tectonic plates moving beneath the surface of these political events. The virtual end of the Cold War in East Asia had clearly meant different things to the foreign policy establishments in Canberra and Washington. For Washington, it meant a careful, calibrated reframing of their regional stance. Détente was a fragile balancing act, a state of affairs that needed careful management, even tendering. The enemy was still at the gates. American power had to be preserved, its credibility maintained. As Kissinger told Peter Walensky, Whitlam's private secretary at the White House in May of 1973, he said, "We do, that is America, have to face the problem of having to analyse some minimum power positions that must be maintained, even if doing this is less than exhilarating or morally satisfying." For Canberra, however, the breakdown, or at least the substantial qualification of the rigid bipolarity of the Cold War, gave Whitlam the freedom to experiment with new ideas about regional architecture, zones of peace and neutrality in Southeast Asia and the Indian Ocean, and updating Australia's traditional relationships with Britain and the United States. For him, détente was a thrilling release from the ideological straitjacket of the Cold War. Australia, he told the National Press Club in Washington in July of 1973, needed an ideological holiday. Now, these were ideas and approaches that certainly unnerved an elite in the United States that had come to expect predictable behaviour from its junior ally. Whitlam, with a fresh mind and a powerful personality, had seen the need to shatter some of the Cold War shibboleths. He had seen Labour marooned on the wrong side of the loyalty divide in Australian politics for too long. So from the time he became deputy opposition leader, Whitlam had sought to nullify the conservative charge that Labor could not be trusted on national security or managing the alliance. Now, that meant cultivating trust amongst American foreign policy politicians and policymakers. But it also meant making a clear and powerful case for why the alliance had to change to meet the demands of a new era. If the alliance had become holy writ in Australian politics, Labor was seemingly barred from accessing the tabernacle. And for many on both sides of the Pacific, some of Whitlam's statements when he was deputy opposition leader and opposition leader were depicted as akin to stealing the holy water from the church. In 1964, for example, when Whitlam went to Washington on a leader's grant, Malcolm Fraser was there at the same time, and Whitlam and Fraser had an argument as to whether or not Fraser had actually said to officials in the State Department that they should simply drop an atomic weapon on the Chinese. But Whitlam also told an American diplomat at this time that Australia only needed security arrangements like the ANZUS alliance for the time being. That's a direct quote, "for the time being." Right? He said that the alliance would necessarily recede in importance as China's posture and position in the region grew, and as Australia itself, he said, started to think in more regional terms. Now, as you can imagine, that set the cap racing among the American diplomatic pigeons. There's no doubt about that. And Whitlam was constantly taunted by American diplomats in private meetings. They used to say to him, "Don't you realise that these sorts of comments will only fan the flames that Labor can't be trusted on managing the alliance?" Nevertheless, he pushed on. As he famously put it a few years later, the alliance had to change from a purely military alliance or die. It could not be a huddling together of three white powers in the Pacific. Whitlam did not see Asian communism as a coiled spring waiting to pounce on a vulnerable Australia. And as such, he said, the alliance could not be the be-all and end-all of Australian foreign policy, a position that was being put in the late 1960s by Sir Keith Waller, who was Australia's ambassador in Washington and returned in 1970. Waller was there from 1964 to 1970, came back to be the Secretary of the External Affairs Department. Now, Whitlam did not pine for ceremony. He sought no coronation on the South Lawn of the White House. He was frustrated by the conservative appropriation of the alliance's rites and rituals. He chafed at the reduction of the alliance to the rapport between a president and a prime minister. Now, as the book shows in some detail, this was quite a shock for Washington. But as the war in Vietnam soured, so the circumstances shifted Whitlam's way. He believed, much like Corwell had put it in that speech of the 4th of May 1965, where he set out Labor's position in opposition to the commitment of Australian troops to Vietnam, Whitlam made the case constantly, even as he denounced the Vietnam War as a failure, as the war of the great lie. Even as he did so, he mixed this with more grandiloquent appeals to America as, quote, the most generous and idealistic nation the world had ever seen. In other words, he took Caldwell's line from that 4th of May 1965 speech about the role of an ally should be to prevent the humiliation of the United States in Southeast Asia. And Whitlam made that line his own when he became leader as well. He said that he wanted to help the American people liquidate the war they had come to hate. He spoke about clearing away the rubble of the past, and he meant the rubble of the alliance, and making a fresh start for the US-Australia relationship. One of the great tasks for Australian statesmanship in the 1970s, he said, would be to channel the Australian-American alliance into more fruitful and constructive directions. Now, all of this time, of course, the Americans are quite happy when Caldwell goes. They see him as ageing and ineffectual. They see him as being pulled too far to the left by some of the factions in the party. And they see Whitlam as a modern, moderate leader who's able to contain some of the more excitable factions on the left of the Labor Party. So Whitlam is seen by the Americans, notwithstanding some of the comments that he makes about the Vietnam War, he's seen as a good thing. When Lyndon Johnson, for example, just to give you a sense of how the Americans approach Arthur Caldwell, when Lyndon Johnson is here in October of 1966, the first time an American president visits the country, the briefing material that is given to Lyndon Johnson before his meeting with Caldwell on the top floor of the Canberra Rex Hotel, and if you're going to Canberra, the Canberra Rex Hotel has actually been refurbished in recent years, you can stay in the presidential suite and see where this meeting took place. But the briefing given to Johnson had basically one line on it. You can talk to him, Mr. President, about his interest in the Civil War. That was it. And there was a big disagreement over the prosecution of the war in Vietnam. That's not surprising. But anyway, Whitlam, as I said, was seen as a good thing by the Americans throughout the late 1960s. He gave them constant assurances that he would preserve the American intelligence installations and preserve American access to those installations. He said they were a grim and awful necessity of the Cold War. He didn't necessarily like them, but he constantly told his US interlocutors in that period, I will protect the installations. Okay. Now, the alliance was indeed changing, and it is important to note that this was occurring in some measure even before Whitlam was elected Prime Minister. In the late 1960s, particularly as a result of the tensions between John Gorton and Lyndon Johnson over troop withdrawals from Vietnam, bombing policy, the lack of broader consultation, American diplomats were starting to send back reports to Washington pointing to the need for a fundamental rethink on how the United States viewed its alliance partner. All right, now, Gorton was absolutely determined to create the same kind of intimacy that Harold Holt had enjoyed. Indeed, on his first visit to Washington, was looking for any sign of American diplomatic or presidential largesse, which might symbolise to the Australian people back home that Johnson took him seriously. And this even extended to things like Gorton expressing the desire to have a private sandwich with the president in the room off the Oval Office, or to be invited onto the Sequoia, the presidential yacht, or to be taken down to the ranch. Now, he got all of those things. He didn't get the sandwich, but he got all of those things, but still felt, as he put it, that Johnson was trying to colonise him or annex him. And Gorton was very frustrated about being treated as a subservient partner, and very frustrated, more importantly, forget about all the ephemera of the presidential visits. What Gorton really was frustrated about was the fact that the Americans wouldn't give a guarantee on what the ANZUS Treaty, in particular Article 4, meant. All right, so Gorton was forced to have a very embarrassing press conference outside Blair House in Washington, where he couldn't spell out what the ANZUS Treaty covered in terms of Australian commitments and American commitments in Southeast Asia, particularly where that referred to Australia's commitment to Malaysia and Singapore under the Five Power Defence Arrangement. Okay. But as I said, American diplomats in the late 1960s were starting to advise their officials back in Washington that this alliance was changing. And they also became aware of the limits of memory. The mellifluous rhetoric that celebrated brothers in arms in the Pacific War and the battles over the Coral Sea struggled to resonate in a changing Australia. They realised that this kind of sentiment no longer cut any ice in Canberra. That kind of appeal to memory could not alone sustain the alliance. It's a very important point, because this is the period in which Gorton is starting to be associated with what came to be known as a new nationalism for Australia. Now, that was originally identified more in economic policy, and Gorton preventing the takeover of the MLC insurance company, preventing foreign takeovers. But nevertheless, it also became associated with the fact that Gorton wanted to strike out a more self-reliant position for Australia in world affairs. Now, he might have struggled and groped to articulate precisely what that meant, but the Americans picked up on it and realised they couldn't have these kinds of warm and glowing appeals to the memory of the Coral Sea battle or the Pacific War, that would no longer be sufficient to sustain this alliance relationship. So although the Conservative governments of Gorton and then William McMahon both in their own way wrestled with the dilemma thrown up by these changing circumstances, and whilst they groped for a solution, they were unable to break free of the Cold War baggage and the habits and beliefs that had served them so well over the previous two decades. In other words, they wanted to believe that the United States obligation still held, that the ANZUS Treaty remained watertight. These leaders clung on tenaciously even as the world transformed around them, trying to make an era of rapid change fit the established pattern. Now, as I mentioned, Australia's ambassador to Washington throughout much of this time, Sir Keith Waller, when he got home to Australia in 1970, wrote that he had been, quote, constantly embarrassed in Washington by a stream of Australian ministers coming through and asking the Americans, in effect, does ANZUS still apply? Are you serious when you say you'll help us? And he said, where the administration kept reiterating its sincerity, the Australians never seemed to be entirely convinced. This was in a private letter that he wrote to an academic at the ANU. Now, it's little wonder that during his first month in power, with the speed of the changes and the new direction in the tone and the style of Australian foreign and defence policy that Whitlam brought in, it's little wonder that he was described by the top Asia specialist in the State Department at the time as a whirling dervish. But after the controversy of the Christmas bombings, Australia was frozen out of the Nixon White House. Now, the real problem for Washington there, and you've got to remember that, as I'm sure many of you would recall, all of the signs up until that period had been pointing to a resolution of the war. Kissinger in October had said that peace is at hand. But due to the intransigence of the North Vietnamese, and indeed of the South Vietnamese, who didn't want their umbilical cord cut, the American umbilical cord cut to their country, Nixon and Kissinger grew increasingly frustrated at the inability to reach a final negotiated peace, to achieve, as Nixon put it, peace with honour. Now, those bombings, which were meant to break psychologically the will of the North Vietnamese and force them back to the negotiating table, drew worldwide condemnation. The Pope said it was an object of daily grief. Leaders from around the world lined up to pour scorn on the American president and this policy. Olaf Palme, the Swedish Prime Minister, who'd long been a stone in Washington's shoe, said that this was equivalent to the Nazi atrocities of the Second World War. As you can imagine, Democrats in Congress also were highly critical. Ted Kennedy said the American president had taken leave of his senses. Now, the Australian protest was actually quite moderate. It had been drafted by Waller. It was in the form of a letter that Whitlam sent to the White House on December the 20th, 1972. And it protested the resumption of the bombing, said that this was a great shock to the Australian people and its government. But the sting came in the tail, because at the end of the letter, Whitlam said he was going to address a joint appeal to the United States and North Vietnam to come back to the negotiating table. In other words, he was putting the United States on the same level as its communist enemy. And this was not appreciated in Washington. The ambassador, James Plimsoll, was very grim-faced, ashen-faced, when he was at Foggy Bottom giving the letter to the State Department. Right, and then he slipped town and came back to Canberra for consultations. Kissinger gets the letter later that afternoon and immediately rings the chargé d'affaires in Washington. Roy Fernandez, a man who, over the next 10 days after this letter, was brought in routinely to be read the riot act by the Americans on what this new Australian government was doing. Now, Kissinger said to Fernandez, "I must tell you, it's over the phone, this is not the way to start a relationship with us. And the president has a particularly warm spot towards Australia. He's quite shocked by this letter. And this must be kept private. If it becomes public, I must say there will be grave consequences for our relationship." And over the next few months, it was a constant grenade, sort of kept in the arms of American diplomats to Australian officials. "If you keep criticising us publicly, we will pull the pin on the ANZUS Treaty. You can't keep criticising the Southeast Asian Treaty Organisation and saying it's moribund, and then say to us, you still want to keep the ANZUS Treaty, because we might therefore tell the Congress that we don't need this treaty anymore." The problem was, the threat was used so often that it started to lose its force. And in fact, they did the same thing with the British government around the same time. Okay. But as I said, Nixon and Kissinger agreed on a policy to freeze Whitlam out of the White House. He won't be received. The Australian ambassador won't be received. No cables will be sent to Canberra unless they are cleared out of the White House. As Kissinger put it to Nixon at the end of December 1972, Nixon was up at Camp David, and Kissinger was back in Washington. He just said, "Mr. President," this is after Nixon has called Whitlam a peacenik, and he's taking Australians down a very dangerous path. And Kissinger says, "But Mr. President, they will need us. When this war is over, they will need us one hell of a lot more than we need them." All right? A true Bismarckian realist seeing things in power political terms. Okay. All right, so as I said, Whitlam well and truly shut out of the White House gates. Satirists in Australian newspapers had a field day with this. So there were all sorts of sort of stories told in the newspapers about, mythical stories about Whitlam and Margaret sort of hanging around Lafayette Square with binoculars waiting to see Richard Nixon or Pat come out and possibly trying to snap a photograph with Nixon and Whitlam in the same shot. But anyway, this was a remarkable period. Now, in the end, I won't take you through all the details because it's in the book. In the end, the impasse was broken. I mean, the New York Times editorialised at this time. They said it was a foolish display of public petulance towards a friend and ally. And remember, this is the same time that Nixon is getting ready to receive the General Secretary of the Communist Party for a state visit to Washington. When Nixon sent Marshall Green off to become America's new ambassador to Australia, all Green could recall, he was given no briefing by Nixon in the White House about what he was meant to do. He just remembers Nixon telling him, "Marshall," about Gough Whitlam, "I can't stand that," and the expletive was deleted. As Kissinger told Peter Walensky, "There was a very bad feeling here towards your Prime Minister." Okay, now over the life of this Whitlam Labor government, Australia did become, as Neville Meaney, who's here tonight, has argued, did become a thorn in the Asian side of America. Whitlam wanted to abandon CETO, he wanted to withdraw Australia's commitment to the five power defence arrangements, and as I said, he was proposing new forms of regional architecture which didn't seem to involve or have the membership of the United States. It's worth recalling that of all the crises which occupied his time as CIA director in this period, flashpoints in the Middle East, coups in Cyprus and Portugal, and a nuclear explosion in India, William Colby felt compelled to add to his list of troubles, quote, a left-wing and possibly antagonistic government in Australia. As Kissinger told Nixon just before he was due to meet Gough Whitlam in July of 1973, "We see Whitlam's Asian policies cutting across our own." In other words, they talked a lot in this period about Whitlam needed to be kept in line and about this errant ally needing to be given an education. Well, he needed to be given the facts of life. Sometimes, as I read these briefings about how to prepare for Whitlam's visit to Washington in July 1973, you could be forgiven for thinking that Whitlam was about to land in Washington in a zoological crate, specially marked, "Handle with care. Caution." Now, as I lay out in a fair bit of detail in the book, concern in Washington about Whitlam and about several senior ministers in the Labor government did reach feverish levels, particularly after the elevation of Jim Cairns to the Deputy Prime Ministership following the 1974 election. So serious did these concerns become that Nixon gave serious thought to cutting off intelligence sharing, drastically reducing military cooperation with Australia, and relocating American intelligence installations out of the country. Right? This is the document, National Security Memorandum 204. And there were some in the Pentagon, including the Defence Secretary, James Schlesinger, who wanted a hard line taken against Australia. Schlesinger, it has to be said, was ready to abandon the alliance. He was pushing the hardest line in the internal bureaucratic struggle about how are we going to deal with this Australian ally. Now, in the end, cooler heads prevailed. The American bureaucracy pulled back from the brink. But it's worth reflecting. Had Nixon followed through on these recommendations, the alliance would have been left as little more than a brittle chrysalis. But for a moment there, this alliance with the United States was perched precariously on the edge of an abyss. I mean, there was even an option canvassed in that paper which said that if sufficient pressure was exercised against the Australian government, it might well cause that government to fall and thus set the stage for an opposition victory. And of course, the thinking was, as I show in the conclusion, there's a great sense of relief in Washington when Malcolm Fraser was elected, because now they have an arch coal warrior, a conservative that they understand, that they feel close to, and a very different Malcolm Fraser comes out of this book to the Fraser that we saw in more recent years. I can talk a little bit more about that in question time if you like. But there are, I think, some deeper lessons here. I do say in the second last sentence of the book that I don't think it's necessarily for historians to sort of pontificate about so-called lessons for those whose job it is to navigate the kaleidoscopic present in which we live. But nevertheless, I do think it's important to draw out some judgments about the significance of the research and the argument that I'm putting forward here. Now, up until the time of Whitlam's election, it was the Australian governments of Menzies and his successors that kept asking for the ultimate guarantee from presidents in Washington, who were seemingly indefatigable in trying to divine, in the words of Article 4 of the ANZUS Treaty, the ironclad commitment of the United States to Australia's national security. And they did so with no success. But from 1972, it was the US government that began to dangle the treaty as a threat, a warning that the guarantee may become infirm. Yet all the while, it has to be said, the Nixon White House assumed that they were talking to the same kind of Australian leaders that had sat opposite them in the 1950s and 60s. This, then, is a vivid and verifiable illustration of the dramatic change that Whitlam brought to the alliance relationship. His style, outlook and policy agenda were an affront to the official American understanding of how the alliance ought to work and how Australia ought to behave as an ally. Now, that jolt underscored a deeper truth for the alliance from the time of its inception in 1951 to the Whitlam era. The very term ANZUS had evolved from a simple treaty obligation to a template for the relationship as a whole. But it was a common currency freighted with unfulfilled expectations on both sides. Whitlam began his parliamentary career questioning the terms of the treaty itself. By the time he left office, he'd redefined it to take account of a broader Australian perspective on the region and the world, and had laid the foundations for a greater sense of self-reliance, not to mention self-respect, within and without the alliance. For American policymakers, the situation was profoundly ironic. Throughout the 1960s, particularly in crises over Indonesia, successive administrations in Washington had watered down the security provisions in ANZUS to such an extent that when they served notice on the Whitlam government about the treaty's very viability, the menace in the threats carried much less force. In other words, it was a real struggle, I think, in Washington to understand these Whitlam winds of change. Now, the Fraser, Hawke and Keating governments all had their moments of disagreement with the Americans. But it should be remembered, it was no great punishment meted out by Washington for doing so. But I would argue, notwithstanding the recent decision over the Asian Development Bank, that we've largely forgotten what it's like to disagree with the United States. If the alliance had evolved into a kind of liturgy during the Cold War, as Bob Carr has recently argued, today it dominates Australia's international personality. Now, how do we account for this? One can appreciate and indeed extol the benefits and advantages that spring from the alliance without losing a sense of history and without losing a sense of Australian autonomy. Now, I worked at very close quarters on the US alliance when I worked in Canberra, both in the Prime Minister's department, on the US alliance desk in the Department of Defence for just under 12 months, and then for a couple of years at ONA. So I've seen the benefits close up, and certainly I never came across a situation where I felt that Australian officials were simply accepting or buying the American line. What I remember most is the contestability at that level. But anyway, how do we account that we are now living through this really quite unprecedented period of bipartisan faith in the alliance? Well, in trying to come to some sort of explanation, I do think it's significant that the worldviews of the present generation of political leaders in Australia were largely shaped, if not during the height of the Cold War, then in a period where the East-West divide was still the major factor in international relations. The post-Cold War period too was dominated by a debate over the unipolar moment and US leadership of a new world order. In other words, this is a generation of leaders not used to an America on the back foot, or at least an America less keen to play the role of world policeman. One sometimes gets the sense that some recent Australian Prime Ministers are trying to force the alliance back into its Cold War mould. So former Prime Minister Julia Gillard's statement in her speech to a joint session of the US Congress in March 2011, where she said that Australia is an ally for all the years to come, of course spoken with the utmost sincerity, carried more than a faint whiff of uncritical obeisance. The great irony, I think, of alliance rhetoric in the post-9/11 era is that it repeats the moral absolutes of the Cold War. It might well be a case of what historian David McLean has recently referred to as having too much memory. All right, and John Howard used to talk about the fact that national security today, he said, rivals the importance it had in the 1950s and 60s. And he spoke about the alliance in that period as if these were the halcyon days of the alliance. Now, no one is going to seriously underplay the closeness of this relationship in the Cold War. But nevertheless, there were periods of significant disagreement and difference, particularly on areas where Australia's vital regional interests were at stake, most particularly West New Guinea and confrontation. Okay, I'm about to finish. Of course, a case can certainly be made to support the view that China's rise means Australia is more important now to the United States than it was during the Cold War. Both the United States and Australia have their key national interests, arguably heavily bound up in this part of the world. And both are wrestling with the central question of our times, namely, how do we deal with the rise of China? Right now, that is driving a new sense of convergence in the alliance. But we cannot be sure if that will be the case in future years. No one in the current debate, it's an obvious point, has the gift for seeing around corners. Clearly, the training facility in Darwin, the American troop rotation, is one manifestation of this convergence. There are others. But there are also some signs of public unease with what this means. Can Australia, in practical terms, extract itself from any military contingency where that base or the troops stationed there come into play? 71% of Australians polled by the Australia-China Research Institute late last year believed Australia should remain neutral in any dispute between China and Japan over the Senkaku or Diaoyu Islands, and that therefore ANZUS should not drag us into a conflict on the side of Japan. It's fascinating, for example, that in 2004, it was the Foreign Minister Alexander Downer, 10 years later, last year, the Defence Minister David Johnston, both of them, in what might be called as unguarded moments, expressed doubt as to whether or not the ANZUS Treaty applied in the event of Sino-American conflict over Taiwan. Now, they may be dismissed as slips of the tongue or gaffes, but it does suggest that there is a certain residual unease within some parts of the Australian foreign policy community about what ANZUS means today. The great risk for Australia is that sentimentalism and solemn incantations of shared values, no matter how much we all identify with those values and embody them, that they get in the way of clear thinking about the alliance and downplay the possibilities of divergence. Of course the United States values Australia as an ally. Of course it does. But history shows that when it comes to its own national interests, the United States, quite understandably, has been decidedly unsentimental itself. Now, it's not that policymakers or indeed political leaders need to be captives to this history. I'm not talking that we should have a kind of a, dare I use the phrase, a black armband history of the alliance and just harp on divergence or cherry-pick moments where Australian and US interests are diverged. But I do think that a sensitivity to how and why differences of outlook and opinion arose in the past can surely help in mapping a way ahead. Not only can a sense of this history help mediate some of the more muscular views of the alliance and cool the passions of the more boisterous alliance cheerleaders, it can also assist in injecting a healthy dose of realism into the relationship. Now, Henry Kissinger might have called Whitlam a bastard. He might have struggled to remember Billy McMahon's name. Remember when Kissinger, as I say in the book, was trying to remember, this is as Whitlam was facing his own downfall in late 75, Kissinger was saying, well, who can we expect now? And they said, Malcolm Fraser, Mr. Secretary. Very vigorous. Well-travelled, very vigorous. He's one of us. And Kissinger was trying to remember, but who was the previous Australian Prime Minister? I just can't quite remember his name. And nor could anyone around the table until the Assistant Secretary of State for East Asia and Pacific Affairs said, Mr. Secretary, it was the guy with the wife. Now, Kissinger might have struggled with that. He might have rolled out an extra metre of red carpet for the New Zealand Prime Minister Norman Kirk just to try and rile Gough Whitlam. He might even have intervened to downgrade American representation at a Coral Sea ball. You know, there was a juvenile pettiness to how the Americans tried to kind of punish Whitlam for straying from what they believed was the common line. But in his latest work, published just last year, I think Kissinger is surely correct that in an age dominated by the 24/7 news cycle, social media, information overload, political leaders still need a sense of history and some kind of vision of the future. But that's much more difficult to acquire now, he argued, and even more difficult to sustain, as he said, in the face of all the pressures that descend on leaders. We should deepen, he said, the current cognitive exercise to a level that is more compatible with conceptual thinking and less geared to the immediate emotion. Now, let me just emphasise again, what I am saying here is not, most decidedly not, about beating the drum of Australian nationalism all the way down Pennsylvania Avenue to poke the US President in the eye or kick him or her in the shins just to make us feel better. But it is about respect, and I think it goes to the very heart of what kind of ally Washington needs in a time of crisis and a time of self-doubt. Alliance razzmatazz can never substitute for analysis, and unqualified support rarely means Australia's distinctive interests are being protected or preserved. Today's circumstances are constantly invoked as new and unprecedented, and yet the interpretive frameworks used to explain them hark back to simpler times. Still, I think, just as in the 1970s, it is certain that Australia and the United States will once more face the dilemmas of divergence. Then, and only then, can the true nature of the alliance be really tested. Thank you very much.
Many thanks to James Curran. Janet Grundy's got copies of Unholy Fury, Whitlam and Nixon at War, and I'm sure James would be very happy to sign copies after the talk. But now we come to questions and discussion, and we've got over 20 minutes, so we've got a bit of time. You take us back, I know some of this is in your book, but take us back to December 1972, and looking at it from the point of view of Nixon and Kissinger, you've got this new government in office, before the election, Whitlam has not been involved very much in the anti-Vietnam War demonstrations, and privately he's indicated his support for the American alliance. He comes to office, the bombing commences, and suddenly you have the Prime Minister writing what you describe as a discreet letter, but not the others. Jim Cairns, who's the industry minister, he's screaming.
Yep.
Clyde Cameron, who's the industrial relations minister, he's screaming. Tom Uren, who's the urban affairs minister, he's screaming. And what you see, what soon becomes the well-known dysfunction of the Whitlam government, is in place within the first month. As all these ministers, and the Prime Minister is also the foreign minister, so there's no one else to talk to, and he can't control his senior ministers, who are completely out of control and very undiplomatic. Now, from the point of view of a Whitlam, of a Nixon or a Kissinger, you would get a bit unhinged by this, wouldn't you?
Sure, sure. Look, it was something of a perfect storm, it has to be said, in the relationship at that time. And I think what Whitlam struggled with was this was simply not in the program. He was so busy implementing all the changes that he promised to bring in at the 1972 election and many years before. And all of a sudden, you get something unexpected and he has to respond to it. Now, his ministers, you're right, simply don't see the need for diplomatic protocol. And in many ways, the Americans are of the view that Whitlam is sponsoring both the slander and then the trade union strikes that follow it. So the trade unions decide to prevent the unloading of American ships in Australian ports. A passenger liner arrives just down here, and the passengers have to be privately ferried ashore. So in many ways, this confirmed for the American administration all the concerns and the worries they had about a left-wing administration coming to power in Australia. Now, I think it is a sign, in some ways, of the kind of internal chaos that was subsequently to plague the Whitlam government later on. There is a real issue with Whitlam struggling to control the agenda at this time. He holds off on criticising his ministers publicly. He holds off on intervening publicly in the trade union strikes. It's really the intervention of Bob Hawke that is able to call off the unions on this point. Meanwhile, you've got the American Longshoremen Association reciprocating the strikes, and Australian beef, tons and tons of it, rotting off the coast of Florida. So there is a confirmation, if you like, for the Americans that, you know, we told you so. Notwithstanding, see, there was a view in the Labor Party that the American Embassy in Canberra had been reporting back to Washington before the 1972 election that this will be a disaster if Whitlam is elected for the alliance, and they may as well give up on it. That's not right. Walter Rice, the American ambassador, is actually quite positive and releases a statement during the campaign. Now, no American ambassador had felt the need to do this before. During the campaign, to say the alliance will be safe under a Labor government. Now, the Conservatives were furious about this, and you had James Plimsoll, the ambassador in Washington, going in to brief Kissinger just before the 72 election to say, Don't worry, Mr. Kissinger. I've briefed the Prime Minister. I've told him not to say anything silly about ANZUS, not to bring up the security installations. In other words, I've steadied this leftist's hands on the alliance tiller. And but once the explosion happens, literally over the bombings, you know, Whitlam initially says, I'm not going to say anything. I'm not going to respond anyway. But I think he felt too that these ministers had been against the Vietnam War from the very beginning. I think he thought, I have to let these guys have their head. There's no way I can control this. Now, by the time things started to settle down in early January, I think Whitlam had realised his mistake.
Now, don't stand in front of the camera, folks. Question down the back. Yeah.
In his recent book, or World War Order, Henry Kissinger never mentioned the name Whitlam. And to me, that was quite a surprise.
Yeah.
Why do you think that was a...
Well, in the voluminous memoirs that that Henry Kissinger wrote of his time in the White House, and indeed in Richard Nixon's memoirs, there's no mention of Australia. At all. No mention of Whitlam at all. Now, well, how do you account for this? I mean, this is a global superpower with a lot of much more important issues on its plate. Now, that's not to downplay in any way the crisis in the alliance at this time, because as I said, there is a comparative dimension here in that Australia, along with Britain, New Zealand, the French, and of course, as I mentioned, the Swedes, are all hopping into Washington at this time over the Christmas bombing. So there's a real problem for the United States in how it's managing its alliances at this time. I suspect this was simply one episode that they didn't deem worthy of going into too much detail on. I think this is simply a case that, in detailing the grand strategy and the memoirs of détente, the opening to China, the arms limitation agreements, hosting Brezhnev, it's very hard for a junior ally like Australia to sort of push its way into memoirs of these statesmen's time in office. But this is not just the same as... This is not just the case for Nixon and Kissinger. Lyndon Johnson's memoirs have a small mention of how Australia was changing at this time, but very little, if any, mention of Holt or Gorton. I think you'd struggle to find any mention of Fraser in anything that Jimmy Carter has written. Ronald Reagan, I don't think there's any mention of Hawke. Clinton barely mentions Keating or Howard. George W. Bush barely mentions John Howard. It's very hard for Australia to get an entry ticket into the memoirs of American presidents.
Question here, then we go there, yes.
I'm just curious about about the influence of Lionel Murphy raiding of ASIO. Was there anything coming out of your book about that?
I'm aware of it. I didn't go into any detail on that in the book. I mean, certainly, what I picked up in the files was that, again, this was another confirmation that you couldn't really trust this government. If they were about to do that to their own domestic intelligence agency, what does that mean for our secrets? What does that mean for the intelligence that we're sharing with Australia? And it percolated through the system and became more of an issue when they started to worry about Cairns becoming Deputy Prime Minister and him wanting access, possibly, to the US intelligence installations. So there was general alarm and consternation about it. But keep in mind, too, that, again, this is a confirmation. I mean, back in the late 1940s, the Americans were very worried about the Chifley government and how, in their view, it wasn't sort of walking and talking the kind of boisterous Cold War language that Americans wanted in the late 1940s. But the Murphy incident, as I said, is mainly something that is often referred back to as yet another example of this government's untrustworthiness on security matters.
Question there.
Yes, right. Before I put my question, Jared, you spoke of Whitlam's sympathy with the American involvement in Vietnam before he became Prime Minister. I think that ended with the Tet Offensive. Okay. I can remember witnessing
it in
the gallery. Yes. Mm. The other thing, you will, to understand the Murphy raid, you have to understand that he was roaring drunk.
John,
right, the question.
Right.
Don't you think it was maladroit of Whitlam to dispatch Peter Walensky, of all people, to Washington to deal with Kissinger?
Well,
the question is, should Whitlam have dispatched Walensky to deal with Kissinger and Washington? Right.
Well, I have to say I disagree, and this is why. Because I don't think that Plimsoll served Whitlam's interests very well in this period. The private briefings that I've seen Plimsoll giving to Kissinger are not helpful, because he's saying to Kissinger, the Prime Minister's got a big mouth. He doesn't think before he speaks. He's trying to bring back the old language of family. Oh, look, you know, we have a very robust democratic process in Australia. You know, we often sort of abuse each other in the Parliament. Therefore, you know, you should just take this on the chin. Everything will be all right. Well, now, I mean, you have to concede to Plimsoll, of course, though, that he's being kept out of the loop because the Americans won't see him. The State Department, though, Marshall Green decides that he will see Plimsoll by night at his home in Washington. But anyway, no, if you read the verbatim transcript of the conversation between Walensky and Kissinger in May, which sorted out the question of the visit, it's very significant because Walensky is the first one to really give a proper briefing about how to understand Whitlam's policies. and basically says you have to understand, Mr. Kissinger, that we've had a political culture in our country that has been dominated by the threat of the red tide, you know, by this idea of the whole, as Corwell had put it, the whole map of Asia being a conspiracy of geography. That's gone now, he says. And he talks about, I mean, he reaffirms, he says, just remember that Whitlam supports the intelligence installations and, you know, that this man is a basic supporter of the alliance. So I think that's a critical moment when, and he says the alliance is going to be the background for some of the things we're doing. Now, that is a very clear enunciation of the change in alliance tone, but I think he also calms some rattled nerves. And in the end, Kissinger's quite comfortable and says, yes, look, we'll have Whitlam and we'll have a party for him and everything will be all right. But a lot more water goes under the bridge between then and November 1975, of course. But I would give Walensky a lot of credit, and the transcript shows it. He does not take a backward step.
Richard.
With all the research that you've done, do you think that the American involvement in the Vietnam War had the effect of preventing the sort of spread of communism with Malaysia, whether it was in Indonesia, whether the Vietnamese were in Laos and Cambodia? What's your conclusion about the importance of the American involvement in that war and the outcome of the last 30, 40 years?
Well, I mean, if you were to take, I guess, the line that Lee Kuan Yew and Owen Harries take on this, it would be basically that you could still justify the war because it gave Southeast Asia time for its institutions to solidify, for their democracies to strengthen. However, I would still have to argue that on balance, it was a disaster. The war in Vietnam was a complete strategic disaster for the United States. And, you know, I mean, the Pentagon Papers give an unrivaled kind of insight into that dilemma that faced Presidents Kennedy and Johnson and Nixon, of course, you know, caught between understanding that they hadn't simply asked the right questions, if you like, about whether or not this culture was, in South Vietnam, was susceptible to the kind of democracy that the Americans wanted to see flourish. These are the conditions on the ground. I mean, they misinterpreted the nature of the war. Where they saw monolithic communism, they missed the fact that this was a nationalist movement that was arguing for the social and political demands of its people. And they failed to ask this question of, was there a point where the defence of American prestige and credibility would actually harm America's national interests? Not to mention the blood and the treasure that it cost it. So for Australia, you know, I think you can make the case that yes, whilst there was a national interest involved in keeping the Americans engaged in Southeast Asia, that came at a very heavy cost because it delayed the emergence of a more distinctive Australian understanding of the region and its affairs. I might just leave it at that. That's a big question.
You get a big question too. Look, I think we're right at the end, so let me ask you this. So you've just spent a fair bit of research on this. What's your next project?
Right. Well, I have to confess being a little bit tired, to be honest. I did enjoy this. What I think I will work on next is either the alliance crisis in the 1980s, the MX missile testing, and the joint facilities, the first Gulf War, the creation of APEC, or perhaps, probably more likely, is I will look at doing some kind of bigger assessment of the United States in Asia. So a book on US foreign policy in Asia after World War II.
That'll make you tired, but just, they'll both make you tired, but just coming back, just tell us a little bit about the work you did in Washington and other places in the United States for this book. I mean, what was that?
I covered a lot of territory. Most of the research was done at the National Archives in Maryland, at College Park. Now, then I went to a lot of the presidential libraries, Kennedy, Johnson, Nixon and Ford, and Look, I mean, I did have some interesting experiences. I mean, that breakthrough document that I found that I mentioned in the talk, National Security Study Memorandum 204, which I have to say I developed probably what many would regard as quite an unhealthy obsession with because I couldn't get it for 4 years. But when I originally asked for it, a lady at the National Archives in Washington said, look, I don't understand why this particular document has been barred. She said, I'll go back and have a look at it out the back. She came back in a couple of hours, and I just remember this hand on my shoulder, and she said, Mr. Curran, you'll never see that document because it will do too much harm to the relationship between our two countries. Now, I said, come on, it's 30 years. I mean, surely can't be that bad. Now, ultimately, it was the Gerald Ford Library that declassified it. Still quite a bit of it redacted, but it was a great opportunity to get a fuller picture as possible, if you like, at these presidential libraries and in Washington, of what the Americans really thought about Australia. And of course, that was balanced with stuff in London, because the Americans were constantly talking to the British about what a problem Whitlam was, and also the material in Canberra at the National Archives and the National Library. So, as is always the case with these things, there's a lot of material on the cutting room floor, so I've still got a bit of work to do on some aspects of this, particularly on the question of Article 4 of ANZUS. There's a lot more that can be done on that period in the late 60s to show Gorton and McMahon really struggling with why the Americans won't come forward and give the kind of guarantee they want.
James, Curran, many thanks. I'll be very brief. As I said, we've got copies of Unholy Fury, Whitlam and Nixon at War, Janet Grundy's got it, but for now, just to say to Dr. Curran, it's a terrific book, huge amount of detail in it. People no doubt will argue about it, and you don't say their conclusions about what you've drawn from the book, but there's an enormous amount of important empirical study, much of it new. So congratulations on the book and on your performance here tonight. Best wishes for the book. No doubt we'll have you back when you get some sleep and write another book. Thank you.
Thank you.
You have been listening to the Sydney Institute podcast. This podcast is proudly brought to you through the support of Microsoft Australia. We hope you enjoyed listening and can join us again soon.